this journey of the Israelites has just begun, and they are celebrating. They're saying things like, can you tell me how it could be any better than this? They've seen God do these incredible things. He's now giving them this pillar of fire to follow him. And they're starting to think, boy, this is it. This is the way the life is going to be. And what we find again of what's happened here is this credible intervention of God through the Israelites at the time. And remember what's gone on. I mean, they have been working in absolute slavery in Egypt under Pharaoh's hand as part of that time in history when Pharaoh had these maniacal construction plans. A lot of people feel that the Israelites were part of the slave labor that built some of the pyramids. And they worked in incredible conditions, being tortured if they didn't meet their quotas, and barely staying alive. And at one point in this journey that we found last week, was that at one point Pharaoh started to feel a little threatened by how numerous the Israelites had become. Even though they were slaves, they were multiplying and reproducing, and Pharaoh was becoming a little intimidated. He thought, boy, they get to be so many, they might overthrow me. So what Pharaoh did was he decided to order the murder of every firstborn son of the Israelites. And so he starts to control them through that ways. And the Israelites know firsthand what it's like to hear the mothers screaming as their firstborn sons, their babies are taken from them and taken to fall on Pharaoh's sword. But then God brings this incredible leader, this reluctant but incredible leader named Moses, and leads them out of captivity. And God rains down plagues of frogs and locusts and lice and all these incredible plagues to get Pharaoh to release them. But even after Pharaoh has released them, he has second thoughts and he sends his army after him again. But this time, God parts the waters of the Red Sea in that miraculous story that we've all heard so many times, allows the Israelites to pass through, and then closes up the water on Pharaoh's army. That's what they were coming into when they were singing, you know, a song like that. And so that's where we pick it up now this week, with now they continue their journey toward this promised land into the desert. And so we'll pick it up this week in Exodus chapter 16. And so the whole Israelite community had set out, and now they were journeying through the desert, following this cloud by day and this pillar of fire by night to eventually what will be their land that's been promised to them by God. But then we pick it up here in 16:2, and it says, in the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you've brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. A little bit of a disconnect there for me. I mean, no wait, I just told you that this is the same story. We're continuing on. These are the same people. This is the same story. These don't sound like those people. These don't sound like those people who are suffering and oppression. I mean, this sounds closer to a group whose life was more defined by kind of all-you-can-eat fondue parties, right? You know, I mean, what's going on here? And these are the same people who experienced all this anguish and then God freed them. Well, I think what's going on here is a little bit of selective recall. You know, a little bit of the forgetting what so previously God has done so recently in their life, and all they can feel is the hunger of their own stomachs now. Now, I mean, you think about that, how recently God had worked those incredible things on their behalf, and then they start whining like this, or what the Bible uses the word grumbling. That they grumble and they forget what God has done, and all they can think about is the hunger in their own stomach. Think about it. I mean, if I was God, and I do ask myself that question every now and then, mostly at home. If I was God, how would I react? What would I do? You know what? I think I would be a little put back. I think I would say, whoa, now hold on a second. Now, aren't you the people that I just rescued you from that guy who was killing all your firstborn sons? Weren't you there for the frogs and the hail parting to the Red Sea? Some of my best work, you know, if I need to say so. Listen, I'm the one who saved you little weasels in the first place, you know, and now I'm getting kind of this attitude back from you. And what we find is they do have this attitude. It's kind of this what have you done for me lately attitude that they bring. And they're so forgetful of the things that God has just done from them. And I think what happens is what happens in our lives a lot when we find ourselves kind of at that place of grumbling. I think one of the things is, it's something I've heard defined as something that's very unique to kind of my generation and those who have come after me, is we have lived in a lifetime where it has never been so compressed because of technology, how quickly something goes from a luxury to a necessity. You know, you think about it, just what was it, 15, 17 years ago, answering machines? Who had an answering machine? You know, and now, you know, if you don't have that or you don't have voicemail, you know, you just, that's an absolute necessity. Or even in the last 10 years with cell phones, I remember my wife and I, when we would try to keep in touch with each other during the day, almost impossible. If I needed to say something to my wife, she needed to pass me some information, we pretty much had to wait until I got home that night. You know, now we both have cell phones, and now we are just outraged when one of us isn't answering the cell phone. You know, and so we leave messages to the tune of, I called your cell phone, you're obviously not picking up, you know. I have to, may have to wait 7 or 9 minutes for this response now. You know, this is what it's doing to my day. They were just a luxury, and now they're a necessity. And now that's not even enough. Now what's next? Cameras in our cell phones, right? Now your cell phone, you know, has to have a camera. You know what? I think I want to pass on the camera. How about you give me a cell phone that just doesn't go from kicking to roaming distance, you know, when I go from my bathroom to my living room? You know, that would be enough for me. I'll pass on the photograph thing. How quickly things go from luxuries to necessities. And because we're so used to that, we, I believe, are a generation that is such much more prone to this thing called grumbling. We wanted as part of the service this weekend to kind of get us all into kind of an experiential mode of grumbling, you know, in some way to kind of get in touch with our inner grumbler. So we thought about, you know, how could we collectively have an experience of grumbling? We started brainstorming ideas, and somebody said, well, let's take away everyone's coffee. Okay, let's just, they come in, there's no, yeah, that would have done it real quick, wouldn't it? Yeah, now we passed on that. But then somebody else had an idea. They said, hey, I know, let's have the coffee out there at the normal carts, but every couple minutes or so when somebody goes up there, let's have somebody go up and wheel the cart away. Yeah, that was somebody, I think, named Todd Henry who had that idea, okay? If you're sending emails, it's T-O-D-D. We decided not to do that. You know, that would be too cruel. But so what we did, but how can we get in this kind of thing of grumbling? And it might be kind of more relevant for those tomorrow morning. I'm not sure. But what we've decided to do is we have secretly replaced all your coffee with decaf. Okay? Ooh, yeah. Listen, all of a sudden the energy just goes out of the room. People are more tired. They're more sluggish. And look how quickly that will translate to grumbling, right? All right, no, I lied. I made that up. We did not replace your coffee. I couldn't stand an angry crowd. We wanted somehow, though, how can we get in touch with this fact that grumbling is such a part of our lives? And you know what I think? When you took a look at what we know about the nation of Israel, I mean, they were the most spiritual people in the history of the world at that point. I mean, they were God's chosen people. And they were the ones who were so quick to go from witnessing miracles to grumbling about what have you done for me lately. And you know what? I just got to tell you, my own little sliver of experience in 8 years at Crossroads, you know who are the people who are quickest to come and start complaining and start picking at stuff that's not the way they want? Church people. It's chronic church attenders. They're the ones who have somehow picked up the gift of grumbling. You know, that's what they do. And I don't know why that is, but it's just something we got to be aware of, that something, we put these walls up when we've been around church so long that we start to have this entitlement mentality and we start to forget what it means to live a life of gratitude and a life of grace. So grumbling, if we're not careful, could tend to define us. Now, so God responds to this. And, you know, like I said, if I was God, I would respond a certain way. But fortunately for the nation of Israel, he doesn't quite respond that way. So we'll pick up the story here in verse 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way, I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. On the sixth day, they are to prepare what they bring in, and that is to be twice as much as they gather on the other days. So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, in the evening you will know what it was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, and in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we that you should grumble against us? I love that little thing at the end. Moses goes this whole thing, God says do this, and then he throws it in. Oh, and by the way, well, who am I that you bring, you know, what? He just kind of wants to remind them, hey, you know what? The whole roaming through the desert thing, not my idea, okay? Who am I that you grumble against? Okay, the frogs, that was my idea. I threw that one in. But everything else, you know, why are you grumbling against me? And God responds to them and says, I will rain down bread from heaven for you. Now, what he says is, there's a couple guidelines here. This bread I'm going to rain down on you, one of the key guidelines is, I will give you enough for that day. You are not to try to store up any more for tomorrow. Because I want you to experience this gift of mine every day, and I want you to experience what it's like to rely on me. So I'm going to send you some, but don't try to store it up because it won't work. You're going to have to trust me for new bread every day. And then we see here in verse 13 what happens. It says, that evening quail came and covered the camp. And in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, what is it? For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, it's the bread the Lord has given you to eat. So this incredible thing happens. God rains down bread and appears on the desert floor like thin flakes like frost. And they can go out in the morning and get it. And you know what's interesting is, this incredible thing happens. They go out the first day and they're mystified. They've never seen, you know, anything happen in this way. And so their first response when they see it is they say, well, what is it? What is it? That's their first response. What is it? As a matter of fact, the word manna, that you break down the word there that's used there, the word manna means what is it? That's the phrase for what is it. They say, we don't have to call it. This is the what is it. This is the what is it. You know, which must have been fairly confusing, you know, early on. Imagine the first day somebody coming out and they see somebody eating in the field, you know, kind of a who's on first kind of thing. You know, they, you know, hey, what you eating? What is it? What is it? Yeah, I know. I mean, what are you eating there? Yeah, this is the what is it. I'll go ask Moses. You know, forget it. You know, kind of thing. They were mystified. So it became the what is it. And they thanked God for the what is it. Now, it's incredible because what we find is they end up wandering in the desert for 40 years. For 40 years, they wander through the desert as God is teaching them lessons before he's willing to allow them to go into this promised land. 40 years, and it also says that for 40 years, God provided them this food. He rained down manna. Every morning, they would go out and God provided for them. Now, what's incredible, equally incredible, is to this miracle of how that happened is also the other incredible thing is that we find in the Bible that the buzz wears off. That at some point, we don't know exactly when, the buzz of this coming out, being starving, coming out and having food magically appear on the ground by God's miracle, that starts to wear off and it's not such a cool thing for them anymore. We look a little bit later, cross over to another book, a few books later in the Bible, in the book of Numbers. And it tells us what happened. Now, we don't know how much time passed here, but here's where we know where we pick it up. It says, the rabble with them began to crave other food. And again, the Israelites started wailing and said, if only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we've lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. Now think about it. They were held in slavery, seeing their firstborn son, infants, be killed. God rained down these incredible plagues to free them. He brought them in the desert, and then he rained down bread on them every day because they were starving. And they filled up with that. And now at some point they say, I can't take it anymore. This manna, I've had too much. At some point the buzz wears off for them. And at some point, instead of them saying, oh God, we're so hungry, and wow, you brought this, what is it? The gift of what is it? That's wonderful. Now all of a sudden they're getting picky about the menu. You know, and I don't know, you know, if they're on kind of a low carb thing or whatever, you know, but this thing of flakes every day, God, it ain't gonna cut it. You know, and they start throwing out, you know, that old delicacies we all have grown to love. Cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. You know what? God, couldn't we have that? Somehow the buzz is worn off for them. You know, I don't know how long it took for the buzz to wear off, but all I know is that God rained down manna on them and the buzz wore off. And the problem was they became numb to the miracle of the manna. And that's one of, I think, our biggest lessons when we take a look at this part of the Israelites' journey is how often do we become numb to the miracle of the manna around us? God rains down blessings on our life, and we so quickly become numb to them that we totally miss the miracle of the manna. I've told you about how my wife and I just moved into a new house. We just built a new house, and it was a pretty incredible journey the way it happened. Back when I worked at P&G, we had thought about moving because I just feel closer to God when I'm around nature. So I wanted to be closer to nature, you know, kind of in some way, closer to some woods, you know, or something like that. And so we decided we're going to move kind of a little ways outside of town. And then we got the idea of wanting to start Crossroads. And we said, no, if we're going to make this happen, we need to stay right here in this close vicinity, you know, Oakley, Hyde Park, Mount Lookout, you know, right around there. So we said, well, that dream is dead. Where are we going to live closer to nature? You know, there, that's fine. We'll just give that up. And what happened was, several years ago, I was out running And I decided to go down this dead-end street that I didn't normally go down. And I went down there. I discovered this undeveloped lot. A small lot, but it was on this slope that went down into this woods. Only a couple minutes from where I was already living. And you could look down there and you could see deer and this thick wood area. I thought, man, this is incredible. I can't believe there's even kind of undeveloped lots, you know, sitting around there. So I looked into it, found out somebody owns it. They're not interested in ever selling it. You know, that's it. And so my wife and I thought about it and we said, well, you know what? Let's just, you know, start praying about it. And we prayed about it and this is what we prayed. We said, you know, God, first of all, we said, I know that we could so easily get caught up in this thing of if I want something, that means God wants me to have it. So, you know, I'll just pray for it. And if I push the right buttons on this cosmic vending machine, eventually, bam, out will pop my treat, you know, kind of thing. So we prayed and we said, God, you know how much closer I feel to you when I'm somewhere around nature. God, if it would honor you for my family to have this property, please give us favor with the owners. And you know what? If it wouldn't honor you, God, we don't want to go anywhere near this. Don't let us have it at all. And that was a prayer that we had because we didn't want to get caught in this thing of I want it, so therefore God must want me to want it. So we prayed that. And I ended up changing my jogging path so that I would go by this house three times a week when I ran. And I was always praying that same prayer when I went by it. I say, God, if it would honor you for my family to have this property, please give us favor with the owners. But, you know, if it wouldn't honor you, we don't want to go near it anyway. And a couple of years went by. About 2 years, and I was running, and I was praying that. And one Friday, I'm running, and I go by, and there's a for sale sign in front of the lot. And it turns out, you know, that it's come up for sale, and there's all these people pouncing on it. There's like a list of like 15 or 20 people, including all these developers. Undeveloped lot, right in Mount Lookout. Wow, you know, undeveloped, we're all on it. And Nancy and I prayed about it, and I went and I met with the people who had bought the land, who were then going to turn around and sell it. And I just kind of explained my story to them and what we felt we'd do with the property. And they turned down every single one of these developers who were offering more money to sell it to us for less. Now, you know what? I want to be careful here. You know, this is not a, you know, just stretch your hand toward the TV set, you know, and get your Mercedes, claim it, you know. That's my best televangelist. You know, that's, and I know it sounds like Bill Clinton a little bit, but I only have one. I'm a one-trick pony, so. It doesn't always work that way. It does not always work that way, but in this case that it did. So, go on the journey, build the house. It's now about 4 years later, we move in. We move in like about 6-7 weeks ago, something like that. We move in, and I remember when we were building the house, going through the contract, trying to cut money. I'm like, oh, we can't do that. Nope. How much, you know, landscaping, how much? No, I don't think so. I'll do that myself. That's easy, you know, you know, kind of thing. Well, now we're in, you know, and I'm staring at, you know, this, you know, just barren desert wasteland, you know, out in front of our house. And I learned little things like, for instance, all that dirt I had them move to build the house. Oh, I can't have that dirt back. No. I need new dirt. I need to pay for new dirt, you know, that's more nutrients and stuff for planting grass. So I have my column and bring them. They dump 30 cubic yards of topsoil. 30 cubic yards in my house. Boom. In two piles. And I'm standing there with a shovel. Okay? I didn't quite. 30 cubic yards. I thought, well, And it was raining. It was pouring down rain when they deliver this. And I start shoveling. If you ever shovel topsoil when it's wet, oh, it's like concrete. I'm shoveling and I'm getting ticked off. And the rain, it's like 2 weeks ago, you know, that pounding rain we had on, it's just pounding down. Finally, I just slam my shovel down. I'm just, oh, this yard, I hate it. Oh, I can't stand this. 51 days. 51 days is what it took for me to become numb to the manna of my house and to start cursing it. 51 days. I couldn't sit there and think, wow, what an incredible blessing that we have somewhere to live. All I could think about was the pain of shoveling this. There's times like that I just wish we could kind of instantly recalibrate when we kind of start to lose our focus. I wish, you know, like at a moment like this, God could just like, bam, take me away to maybe work for half a day with a UN relief worker in Afghanistan. You know, or take me away for a day maybe with Titus down in South Africa calling on some of the AIDS victims down there. God, you know, kind of doesn't quite work that way. But I have found kind of a way that I kind of recalibrate in some of those moments where I am just missing the miracle of the manna. And I am slipping into this kind of grumbling mode. I found slipping into this probably, I don't know, it was about 5 years ago or so. And I ended up, I just took a half day and I went down to the library downtown and I talked to some researchers there. And I started combing through some of the United Nations and the World Bank statistics on what the world as a whole looks like and who has what. And I found I keep these kind of statistics in my office because it just kind of helps me kind of recalibrate on kind of where I am on things and be able to reappreciate kind of the man in my life. Best way I kind of, I think I kind of visualize it here is with this. These tennis balls. This is it's 100 tennis balls. 100 tennis balls. And these tennis balls represent 100% of the world's population. Okay? So one tennis ball is 1% of the world. 100 of them here, 100% of the world. If you start to take a look at just kind of where, even in the midst of our misery, where we sort out, I think it's really helpful recalibration. If, like, for instance, you ask the question, okay, well, what percent of us in the world, what percent of us get a good meal every day? Good meal. How many, you know, well, okay, we know there's a few. We know there's a few who don't get a good meal every day. We have to take those out, you know, kind of thing. Well, actually, what you have to do is 50% of the world is suffering from malnutrition right now. 50% of the tennis balls, they're gone right now. 50% of the world does not go to bed with food in their stomach. You can't finish there. Actually, you know what? Another 20%, 70% of the world can't read. 70% of the world is illiterate. So if you find yourself just getting a good meal every night and you can read a page of your child's writing or you can read a page of the newspaper, you are in this remaining 30%. 70% of the world. It doesn't stop there, though. I haven't even started to talk about how many people have clean, safe drinking water. How many people have a dry, warm or cold, if needed, roof over their heads. Start to throw those things on. As a matter of fact, if I just put two of those statistics together, if I just say, how many of these people in the world, how many of these people got a good meal yesterday and have a chance of a college education? One percent of the world went to bed last night with enough to eat and have a chance of a college education. Wherever you are, you got to realize most likely you are one of the ones. I don't want to belittle our stress. It is very real and we have very real problems. But you know what? Are your sales trends looking down? That's real stress. I know that. You were relying on a bonus that didn't come through. That's real stress. You know, I know that. Did you get enough to eat last night? You're one of the ones. You get passed over for that promotion once again, and you know in your heart, you are the most worthy person of that promotion. That happened to you once again. Did you have somewhere to sleep last night? You're one of the ones. Your kids maybe got a cold or something and keep you up all last night. That stinks, I know. That can absolutely trash your week. Do you have a doctor to take them to the next day? You're one of the ones. We become so numb to the manna that God has placed in our life. You know what? And this is where I kind of jump off the Bible, and this is kind of my own little interpretation here. But I think that a lot of our prayers sometimes, by the time they get up to God, how they're translated to God is, God, look at all that stuff the 1% has. I'm in the 2%. Why can't I have all that stuff the 1% has? God, why me? God causes water to fall down from the sky, go into the ground, stuff grows up, we put it in our mouth and eat it, and it gives us energy and life, and we don't call it a miracle because he does it every day. We are one of the ones. We need to find a way when we're slipping into our grumbling, we need to find a way to recalibrate. We recalibrate to gratitude. We say, God, would you show me the miracle of the manna that I'm just walking over every day? God, help me realize the manna that you have rained down in my life, even if it's a little different than the manna that you've rained down on the people across the street. God, I am thankful for the manna you've given me. We need to recalibrate to gratitude. Well, back to the nation of Israel. You know, kind of even before that, when they've just had this manna rain down on them, and they're trying to figure out what to do with it here. Go back to Exodus 16, verse 19-20. It says, "Then Moses said to them, 'No one is to keep any of it until morning. However, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. What we find is God saying there's a very basic issue of trust I want you to have with me. I am your creator, you are the created. There will be a relationship of dependence that you will need to have on me, or you will never be the person you were created to be. So there's an issue of trust here. God says, I'm going to give you the manna, but you're going to have to go out every day. And don't try to hoard it up. Don't try to store it up for tomorrow. And what happens? Some of them decide to do it. Some of them decide, what they basically say is, God, I know you did that whole cool thing with the plagues and the frogs, you and all that, and that Red Sea thing, that was really cool, and now you've rained manna down on us, that's wonderful, but God, I think I'll take it from here. I think I'll take it from here. So some of them see this manna, and they go out, and they scoop up more than they need, and they try to save it for the next day. And what's it say that happened? They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. They take this manna, and through their hoarding strategy, they turn manna into maggots. Sound familiar? I think a lot of us can not only pass by the miracle of the manna in our own life, but the other thing that we can do is we can operate by this hoarding strategy. Wow, I'm one of the people God has rained manna down on. Now I am going to hoard it up, and I've got to protect it tightly because it's up to me from here on out. Or we have plans where we sock away so much of this manna so that when we turn 65, we can do something else, and then we'll have that manna stored away for us. And God tells the Israelites the same thing he tells us. He says, I am not into the hoarding strategy. As a matter of fact, I will not bless the hoarding strategy. If you try it, you will turn your manna into maggots. But we do it. We turn our manna into maggots. And the problem with the hoarding strategy, I think there's, you know, kind of three problems with the hoarding strategy. First one is that we break this relationship of dependence on God. And we miss out on so much of what God's created our lives to be because we start to cling to it so tightly, start to think that it's about us and it's not about him. And that we can somehow live in a relationship that's anything other than dependence on our creator. Second thing with a hoarding strategy, the problem that it has for us, is that we start to settle. We take manna and we settle for the maggots that it becomes. And the next day we wake up, it's become maggots, you know, but we kind of settle for it. And what we miss is we miss the new manna that God had for us. We miss the blessing that God had waiting for us because of our hoarding strategy. We've taken things into our own hands. A couple of years ago, Nancy and I were at this retreat out in Northern California, and it was a pretty rustic kind of deal. I mean, sleeping on, you know, bunk beds, you know, kind of every day, and then at least one night, you know, kind of had to camp outside down by the river, you know, in sleeping bags and all this kind of stuff. And I'm not kind of like Mr. Rustic guy, okay? I know that probably comes as a shock to most of you, but I love the outdoors. I love the outdoors, but at night, I'm more of a CNN, you know, kind of thing, you know. So I love the God's created beautiful outdoors as long as we have cable access, you know, at night. Not into the really rustic thing. So I'm copying a little bit of an attitude here. Oh, man. And so one night they come to us and they say, and there was about, I don't know whether like 10 couples involved in this thing. And they say, hey, let's pack up the cars, bring your sleeping bags and pillows. We've got a surprise. We're not going to tell you. Oh, boy. These are the people who brought us sleeping on rocks down by the river. Okay, I know where this is going, and I'm kind of whining, and are we even going to eat? I don't even know if we're going to eat when we get there. Oh, man. So we had to start. Our train of cars had to stop in the middle of the National Forest as we were entering it at this gas station. Somebody had to get gas. They said, well, hey, I'm taking this into my own hands. I went inside. I said, I'm going to stock up on something because I don't know. You know, we may get there, and we have to eat what we kill, you know, or something like that. So I go in, and I grab these they're the little things in a box, but they're kind of like mini Hostess apple pies, you know, okay, apples, you know, so that'd be good for me, right? So I get these little fried Hostess apple pies. Nobody else wanted any, but I go in, I'm like, oh, well, I'm not going to go hungry tonight. So I'm sitting there, kind of trying, before I notice, I ate a whole box, you know, kind of a whole box of them. And we get there, it's about an hour later in the middle of the National Forest, we get there, and we pull up to this incredible timber frame lodge that this millionaire has built. And it turns out that one of the couples has volunteered to pay for all of us to go away for the night to this incredible lodge in the middle of this national forest and to stay the night there in this guy's house. And we come in, and the servants are standing there, and there's a French chef that's standing there with this incredible feast laid out on this table. And I'm kind of trying to hide the little white frosting ring I have on kind of my lips, you know. couldn't quite enjoy it that night. You know what? I was into the hoarding strategy. I'm going to get mine. I'm not going to trust these guys. I'm going to get mine. And in doing so, I missed the feast. I was so stuffed, I missed the feast. And our hoarding strategy leads us to miss the feast God has for us. We say, I'm going to take this into control. And God has another plan for our life that we would never know if we stepped back into a relationship of trust in Him. But we don't, and so we miss the feast. And the last thing the hoarding strategy does is it stops us from sharing manna with others. It becomes all kind of about us. I remember when we first started Crossroads. I don't think I've ever told this story before up here. When we first started Crossroads, it was several months after we started, and we were deciding, kind of the board at the time, we're deciding, wow, even though we're just a couple hundred people right now, the church, we feel like God really wants us to step out in a significant way and share our resources with those who don't have as much. And so we did some research, we prayed about it, and we ended up starting this relationship with this food kitchen in Over the Rhine. We prayed about it, we sent a letter to them, and we committed this set amount to them on a monthly basis. We were going to support them. Next day, we get a phone call from them wanting to know who we are because we've just become their largest supporter worldwide. We're like, wow, you know, that's incredible. I don't know. We told them two things. One is, you know, well, we really felt like that's how much God wanted us to give. And two, we don't really know how we're going to pay that. So it's kind of a good news and bad news kind of thing for them at that point. You know what? God met our needs. We weren't quite sure how that was going to measure up, that significant amount of support, with paying our salaries. There were only three of us at the time on staff. It was to pay us. I don't know how that's all going to add up, but we feel like God wants us to do it. And you know what? And again, I want to be very careful here because God works in different ways, and there is not this contract of I do this and God does this. But I want to tell you, in this case, nobody knew about the commitment we had made. Just three of us on the board did, and that's it. That was it. Nobody knew about the commitment we had made. And within a couple weeks, in the weekend offering for this little church of, you know, like 200 and some people, we got an anonymous check for $100,000. It's the largest gift we had ever received at that point. God just stepped in and said, you know what? If you will be generous with the manna, I will keep meeting you. And I'll meet you right where you're at. See, the thing is, we need to be generous with the manna. God does not give us manna for our hoarding strategies. Here's the thing. Based on the picture that I understand of God in the Bible, God is always looking to see what those who have more will do for those who have less. God is always looking. God is always looking to see what those who have more money will do for those who do not have money. God is always looking to see what those who have power will do for those that are being oppressed. God is always looking to see what those who have experienced the sweetness of community will do and the risks they will take to share that community with others. God is always looking to see what those who have more will do for those who don't. And we don't get there through a hoarding strategy. And some of you, I know, you know, some of you, it's been really cool hearing the stories that are starting to bounce around about this crazy campaign journey that we went on, you know, where we said, you know what, we want to set aside some extra money of our give. We want to give some extra so that we can add on to this facility for our friends and neighbors, so we can build this AIDS hospice in South Africa, so that we can do this work in Over the Rhine that we're looking at doing, and so that we can launch crazychurch.com as a free resource kind of thing. We stepped out to do that, and the stories that are starting to swirl around, and I think they're really healthy. The stories some people are sharing, and not in kind of a prideful or a resentful way, but these stories people are sharing about kind of the things they've given up to be able to meet their monthly commitment. And people talking about, well, you know, we've got to have different plans on Friday nights right now for the next couple of years because we forfeited, you know, kind of what we were going to pay for going out, you know, on those Friday nights or whatever. Or I've chosen not to trade this car and I've chosen to run it in the ground, you know, or different things like that. I think God looks at that and He sees people who are not into hoarding strategies with their manna. There's a story that I've been told about what happened right after World War II was over. And the Allied troops were coming in and they were liberating these cities. And one of the things that would happen when Allied troops would liberate these cities is that there would be a significant number of homeless children, a significant number of orphans that had been orphaned by the war. And so the Allied troops very quickly set up these homes for all these orphan children. And they put them in these homes, and the first thing that they would do, because most of them were practically starving, the first thing they would do is they would really ramp up their eating. So they would feed them very well so that they knew what would happen with that food is not only physically it'd be important, but psychologically it'd be important that they would know that they were going to be fed from day to day. And so they would do this, and more often than not what happened is a couple of weeks would go by and these kids were getting physically stronger and they were eating three great meals a day and everything. But what was happening was the kids weren't getting any sleep. They found that as well they were feeding them, as nice as they were taking care of them, they would go to bed at night very restless and very stressed and they wouldn't sleep during the night. And from a sheer physical perspective, they said, these kids are not going to do well if they don't get in some healthy sleep cycles. So they didn't know what to do. They brought in this psychologist. And he came up with this idea. And what they started doing was, when they would put the kids to bed every night, they would hand them a crust of bread to hold. And they would tell them, they would say, now, this isn't for eating. If you want any more food, just tell us and we'll bring you more food. No, this bread is for holding. You're just supposed to hold it. And they found that very quickly the kids started sleeping through the night. Because they could hold in their hand this reminder of their provision. You know, the fact is, for all of us, God has rained down bread in your life. And it may look different than the people down the street. But God says, you know what? That's not your story. Your story is the manna I have rained down on you. But so often our stress and our lack of trust is related to this issue of gratitude. We're not thankful for the manna God has given us, or we just crunch right over it during the day because we become numb to it because the miracle happens every day. Or we become so stressed about the future and not being able to store it up that we don't know what's going to happen. And God says it's an issue of gratitude and it's an issue of trust. Will you take this manna and will you breathe life in yourself and others with it? Or will you try to hoard it? If you would please, you were given your own little thin flakes of frost sometime during the service. And we ask everybody to take two of them. If you still have those, if you want to take those in your hand, I ask you to do something with those. If you just close your eyes with me a second. And imagine that journey that the Israelites had been on. Imagine these mothers who had become so accustomed to the cries of their children as their children were dragged away by Pharaoh. Imagine the miracles. Imagine wading through the frogs. Imagine walking through the floor of the Red Sea with the crashing walls of water around you and then turning around and seeing them close in on your persecutors. And then imagine getting to the desert. And it's not as you thought. And this thing's not quite adding up. And you don't remember. You can't remember the last time you felt a full stomach. And then God rains down bread on you. And you go outside and there's these thin flakes of frost on the ground. And you pick one up. You just want to take one of those and put it in your mouth right now. And just taste the sweetness. God has rained down this on you. And while you hold that taste in your mouth, I want you to just ask God. We're just going to take a minute of silence here. Ask God to help you recalibrate. Help all of us. God, starting with me, help us see the manna that we just walk past in our life. Help us grow a heart of gratitude out of that. God, and through that sweetness in our mouth, help us remember the relationship of reliance we were created to have with you. And help us build a life of trust in you.